Welcome to Voices, the EISA podcast, the space for cutting-edge research in the discipline of international relations, and the audible companion to EISA, the European International Studies Association. This podcast sets the stage for deeper insights into award-winning papers, books, and theses, as much as it provides a room for the critical engagement with key concepts in political and sociological thought. Voices, the EISA podcast, feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible.
Hello and welcome to our Voices podcast. My name is Judith Koch, doctoral researcher at the University of Sussex, and I'm delighted to be hosting yet another episode today. And in this episode, we'll be talking about dependency theory. What's at stake with the ways we must understand the unequal distribution of power and wealth within states and regions? As of course, they're not always determined by political domination or military force, but through intricate economic dependencies and hierarchies. Dependency is often perceived as a kind of technical problem that can be fixed, but if you ask a dependency theorist, that problem isn't that easily solved, because dependency is a situation where an economy in the so-called periphery is conditioned by the development and expansion of another economy in the center. Dependency theory provides a critical lens through which we can understand the persistent inequalities shaping our world, which extend beyond borders, influence global conflicts, financial systems, and that work at the intersections of gendered and racialized oppression. Having emerged in Latin America in the 1960s and 70s, dependency theory has most recently been used to, for example, overcome Eurocentrism in the study of the global political economy, to address the asymmetry of environmental impacts on different countries and more. And I'm honored to welcome Dr. Felipe Antunes de Oliveira today as our today's guest, a leading scholar on this topic. He's a senior lecturer at Queen Mary University London with a rich background in Latin American political economy and international relations theory, and his research interests span dependency theory, decolonial theory, and uneven and combined development. Felipe's unique dual perspective as a scholar on the one hand and as a career diplomat on the other hand deeply informs his critical approach to development discourses. Felipe worked at the Department of South American Politics of the Brazilian Ministry of External Relations from 2012 to 2014. He acted as advisor to the Brazilian Executive Director at the IMF from 2019 to 2020 and is currently on a secondment to the Brazilian Ministry of Finance working as Coordinator General of International Economic Cooperation. His latest book, Dependency and Crisis in Brazil and Argentina, A Critique of Market and State Utopias, proposes a way to overcome the problematic binary distinction between development and underdevelopment, which is what, amongst other things, we'll be talking about today. But first and foremost, welcome, Felipe. It's such a pleasure to finally see you again, although only online because you're in Brazil at the minute. So yeah, thanks so much for being our guest today.
So first, thank you so much for having me, Judith. It's great to see you.
Yeah, let's jump in. And I'd like to ask you first of all to please elaborate a bit on the concept of dependency in the context of the discipline of international relations and how it actually differs from past forms of intersocietal exploitation.
Dependency is a self-reproducing hierarchical relationship between politically independent capitalist societies, right? So the self-reproduction of dependency happens through deeply embedded social, economic, and cultural structures based on gendered and racialized forms of oppression, which largely constrain the development possibilities of dependent societies while sustaining the wealth and the power of central societies. Dependency is therefore a form of intersocietal hierarchy. And if you look at global history, of course, you see many forms of intersocietal hierarchy. So hierarchy among societies has been present at several points. Dependency differs from past forms of intersocietal exploitation because it does not rely primarily on political subordination or the threat of military coercion. So it's very easy to see a difference here. When you have gunboat diplomacy, when you have full-blown imperialism, when you have colonialism, there you have like direct extraction of surplus through violence, right? And the puzzling thing that gives origin to dependency is when you have independent political units that are still willing to give their surplus to other units through economic means. So dependency can be seen as the international relations equivalent of the transition from the extraction of surplus value primarily through coercion to the extraction of surplus value primarily by economic means, which is arguably a core characteristic of capitalism. This definition of dependency is the one I am proposing. I put together this definition in the Springer Encyclopedia of Human Geography. And my aim with this definition is to update classical definitions of dependency. If you look at most definitions of dependency, you find two problems. First, either they look exclusively at the past and define dependency solely in relationship to the dependency theory literature of the 1960s and 70s, as if dependency was a thing from the past, and they say, oh, dependency is what these guys were doing. And of course, we respect a lot what these guys were doing, but dependency is a live tradition. So we are entitled to come with our own new definitions of dependency that are more adequate to what we see today and that dialogues with other forms of literature as well. And in the case of classical definitions, they tend to overemphasize external determination and silence about gender, race, and even class. Although those guys were Marxists, their definition of dependency sometimes is very, very externalist. So let me quote here a very classical definition of dependency by Teotônio dos Santos. There's this article that he published in 1970 called The Structure of Dependency. And there he defines dependence in the following way, and I'm quoting. He says, by dependence, we mean a situation in which the economy of certain countries is conditioned by the development and expansion of another economy to which the former is subjected. So dependency is really, again, a hierarchical relationship, according to dos Santos, but it's one unit dominating the other. And this is problematic in many levels, right? We know that dependency really depends on social structures as well. We want to highlight the role gender, class, race play in reproducing dependency structures. So I think we need to update this old definition of dependency if we want dependency theory to be useful today. Crucially, however, I do not claim that my definition of dependency is the only correct or possible definition of dependency. Quite the contrary, debates about the very meaning of dependency are part of dependency theory, right? So I think that one thing that has really stifled dependency theory was this idea that we should all agree on a certain way of defining dependency. I think dependency theory is really about a conversation on what dependency is and how we can understand dependency in different contexts, and not about finding a definition that is set in stone. So another way of defining dependency is not by its content, that is what dependency really is, but by its scholarly practice. And I do a very similar thing with neoliberalism and neo-developmentalism. We can talk about that later. So the important thing is what people who talk about dependency do. Even if we do not agree on a unifying definition of dependency, what are these people saying? And here my claim, which I have been advancing in a series of articles published in the Review of International Political Economy with partners such as Ingrid Van Graven from King's College and Nadine from Colegio de Mexico, is that dependency is a school of thought or an intellectual tradition, right? And it's therefore comparable with realism or liberalism or constructivism and the like. So as there is no definition of what realism is, if you open any IR handbook, there will be a different definition of realism, different definition of liberalism, a different definition of constructivism. You can think of different definitions of dependency. It's a broad theme of ideas, a broad conversation about this form of hierarchy that is not defined by violence, but by economic means. In fact, dependency can be seen as a founding perspective of IPE. It has been marginalized towards the end of the 70s and 80s, probably because it came from the Global South and because most of the writings in dependency were done in Spanish and Portuguese, not in English. But it was there right at the beginning of IPE. I think there are probably a history to tell about Latin American origins of IR that would be similar to the story that Vitalis tell about the origins of IR in the Howard School, for instance. So Black American histories of IR, or the history of IR that Patricia Owens tells, looking at the role women play in the origin of IR. Probably we can tell a similar story looking at Latin American contributions to the origin of IR. Certainly, we can tell the story in relation to IPE. So dependency theory was really there at the beginning of IPE debates. And at some point, it started to be ignored by Global North scholars. So they engaged with it in the 70s and 80s, and in the 90s, they just decided it was not worth it. So now that you're looking to decolonize IR and rediscover voices that have been marginalized in the history of the discipline, it's really about time to revisit dependency theory and reclaim the space.
Right. And I think, yeah, that's an interesting point because, I mean, initially kind of developed by especially Latin American scholars, their initial motivation was probably not to bog down Eurocentric IR. But what motivated these Latin American scholars in the first place? Like, what were their primary inspirations behind this development? Why did they come up with that?
Oh, yeah, that's a very, very good point. So certainly they were not motivated by disputing the field of IR, right? They were motivated by real political struggles in Latin America and by the problem of development, which is something that we can elaborate later. So there was this big idea that development was not working in Latin America. So why was it the case and what kind of development can we achieve then? I think those are really the big topics. But at the same time, I think there was also the clear intention to antagonize with the CEPAL, which is the United Nations Economic Commission for Latin America, was hugely influential in the 50s and 60s. So there was an idea of disputing intellectual space there and creating possibility of thinking about policies from a different perspective. So I think dependency theory really has a foot in practical policy debates, but it also has a very strong footing in theoretical debates, particularly about development and the role international relations play in development. That's why it really belongs to the discipline of international relations, because the international is right front and center in dependency theory.
Okay, thank you. And how did dependency theory develop over time, including its divergence into different strands and interpretations?
Yes, so the first thing is what we were saying before, that contrary to other strains of IR and international political economy, which evolved in the safe environment of Global North universities or foreign policy debates in the US or in Europe, dependency really developed in struggle. So here we have a very similar story to anti-colonial thought, and I'm thinking of Amilcar Cabral, Fanon. So the key authors of dependency theory were really engaged in political struggle. So it is an evolution that is really marked by repression, quite brutal repression, really. So after the 1964 coup in Brazil, which installed a right-wing capitalist dictatorship in Brazil for 2 decades, the original group of dependentistas who originally gathered in the University of Brasilia, and I'm thinking here of Marini, Dos Santos, Bambija, and Gunda Frank also joined them as a visiting scholar, this original group had to disperse, right? They lived in disguise for a few months. Marini was actually arrested, tortured, and exiled to Mexico. Dos Santos and Bambija lived in disguise for a few months. They actually had a baby during this period using fake names. So you can imagine what it does to your political international thought to live under repression, and an repression that can actually torture and kill you. So that was a pretty dramatic period. Then a few years later in Chile, during Allende's government, dependency had its heyday. So finally, these people managed to gather again in Chile. And they were coming from different places. One of the origins, as I said, was the group of intellectuals from the University of Brasilia. Another origin was a group of intellectuals from the University of São Paulo, led by Cardoso. And in that period in Chile, in the early 1970s, you start to have a split forming between two groups there. The interesting point is that at that point, they were still dialoguing, right? So it was a friendly intellectual split, but it was a split. There was one side of the dependency theory that came closer to the CEPAL, to the developmentalist tradition, and they gathered around the IUPES, which was an institute created by CEPAL and directed by Cardoso. And this group of people studied dependent development. So the key idea here, the idea that gives coherence to this group, is Cardoso's idea that you can eventually have development even in conditions of dependency. If you use external capital wisely, you can promote some form of catch-up, although this form of catch-up would be determined by foreign multinationals. So there was no contradiction there between dependency and development. And he accused the other side of the dependency debate of not allowing for any form of development, which was a bit of a straw-manning strategy. And I will go back to that later. And the other side of dependency theory gathered in the University of Chile in a center called CESO, and they produced much more radical scholarship arguing for revolution as a form to overcome dependency, because they saw the internal sociological origins of dependency. They saw that ruling classes in Latin America were intrinsically related to dependency relations, and this is the expression that Vannevar Bihar uses. They are dominant ruling classes, meaning that these ruling classes have no intention to develop national process of development, and the relations of production were based on super exploitation, which is a crucial concept coined by Marini. And because of this internal sociological structures in conjunction with external conditions, this form of domination could only be overcome through revolution. And they were really, really inspired by the Cuban Revolution, of course. So the idea that they put forward there is that to overcome dependency, we have to fundamentally change societies in Latin America and aim to have a different form of relationship with the external capitalist world.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. So while these Latin American scholars, as you just said, share a common interest in the dynamics of economic polarization under global capitalism within their context, so in Latin America, they were convinced that at least some kind of change or transformation could be achieved. However, if we look at the Western perspective, most prominently the Wallerstinian understanding of the world economy as a world system with a core and a periphery, so at world systems theory, capitalist development in the core and underdevelopment in the periphery are understood as two interdependent sides of the same process. What are the challenges now when it comes to overcoming this development-underdevelopment dichotomy, especially given the complex challenge this poses when we wanted to reconcile the understanding of societal development without taking a Eurocentric imperial stance? And how do you address this problem in your own work?
Thank you, Judith. This is such an important question, and I think it really helps us update dependency theory. So I will take a step back here and talk about some of the main critiques to dependency theory, and I think we'll get that, because I think this critique that dependency theory does not really have a clear definition of development itself is one that I find the most important critiques that we have to address if we are still using dependency theory, or at least engaging with dependency theory. So as I said, after the heyday of dependency theory, a series of critiques emerged, right? And from the left, you had Brenner's critique of Wallenstein and Gunder Frank, which was a pretty devastating piece that many Marxists in the West know, which aimed more at world system analysis than dependency theory, but is seen to this day by many, I would call them Eurocentric Marxists, as a total dismissal of dependency theory, right? And the idea here was that dependency theory, just like world system analysis, saw the emergence of capitalism as a commercial phenomenon, not a phenomenon of production. And this, of course, was not the case at all in the writings of Marini, Dos Santos, and Mobija. Was a little bit the case in some of the writings of Frank, and was certainly the case in the writings of Wallerstein. So there's something to the critique there, but to my view, it does not apply to the whole tradition of dependency. From the right, you have a series of critiques about the lack of quantification in dependency theory. Of course, we are, again, here talking of the 1970s, so you have a really push towards formalization of economics as a science. Ingrid van Graven writes more about this. And dependency theory was really staunchly against this form of formalization. They do really qualitative economic analysis. And so you had a series of critics from the right saying, oh, you are not defining your concepts right, you are not quantifying your concepts, which for me is, again, really missing the point of the kind of research that they were trying to do. You also have a very common critique voiced by Gilping, for instance, in his 1987 book, and it goes more or less like this. It says that dependency theory is a theory that development is impossible in the global periphery. But then look at South Korea, look at Singapore, look at Taiwan, and this country show that development is possible in the periphery. And of course, today we have China, which is an even bigger problem. What do we do with China within the dependency tradition? But the point that Gilping was making is that dependency is fundamentally wrong because there are poor countries that become developed. So the idea that peripheral countries cannot develop is fundamentally wrong. There is therefore no structural impediment to development. It's just really a matter of getting your policies right and then you will develop. I find this critique very, very frustrating because they really fail to engage with the best dependency authors. And they, to my view, they purposefully misrepresent dependency. And they really create this kind of straw man. So it would be very hard to do the same with, say, realism or liberalism, to reduce realism to like the Brutus idea that is always war of everyone against everyone, or liberalism to the idea that, oh yeah, we have eternal peace because we have common interests, right? Nobody would dare to do that, but they dare to do that with dependency because the dependency authors were writing in Spanish, Portuguese. They were not part of the conversation of the Global North, so you could just strawman that. So if you read Marini, Dos Santos, Bambija, you'll see that they have much more nuanced arguments. They never claimed that development was totally impossible in the periphery. They pointed to structural constraints. They pointed to the connection between capitalism, global capitalism, forms of exploitation, and the kind of social structures and productive structures you had in the global south. And they claimed for revolution, which proves that they believe it could be changed, right? So the possibility of change was really, really a key part of dependency theory. So I think this is really just misrepresentation of dependency theory, these critiques that are most common to see. But then there is one critique that is a critique that is serious for me. That is the one you just mentioned in your question. That is, okay, dependency theory seems to be using a notion of development that is in itself fundamentally problematic. And this critique comes from, of course, the post-development literature, the decolonial literature, that sees development as a fundamentally problematic concept, right? And you can find that in the writings of Ramon Grosfogel, but also Henrique Dussel and Ibo Quijano. Contrary to other critiques, Grosfogel actually read the best dependentistas, and he directly engages with Wene Bambija. So it's really refreshing to see that, someone critiquing dependency theory having read the key authors. And he recognizes that the historical importance of dependency, and he also denounces Cardoso as a form of developmentalism. So he shares a lot of things with Cardoso, Bambija, the Marxist authors of dependency. He highlights the central contradictions in the first generation of dependency, though, because they relied in this idea on this idea of development as a final goal, right? They say, okay, we are not developing, so we need a revolution so that we can overcome this form of development. So they still reproduce this idea that there are developed capitalist countries and there are underdeveloped capitalist countries. And of course, the origins of these ideas are very, very problematic. The key author here is Arturo Escobar, who became extremely influential in the 1990s, showing that development was really, really part of a form of domination the U.S. created in the post-war. There are some authors today that are questioning this theory of development and showing the importance of global south, origins of development as well. I'm thinking here of Christy Thornton from John Hopkins University and many others kind of recovering global south origins of development. And that is all very good and very important. And the work of Cepal is also very important in the formation of development itself. So the book by Margarita Fajardo does a great job showing how Latin America created its own world of development. But still, they all reproduce this idea that there are developed countries, there are underdeveloped countries, and eventually the underdeveloped countries can become like the developed countries, right? So they reproduce a dichotomy of development that I find extremely problematic, and that is, for me, at the core of many problematic policies that we see in Latin America today, and that's what I talk about in my book. So I overcome this dichotomy through the concept of uneven and combined development. I think the concept of uneven and combined development is really the key to think about development without having to reify the fact that some countries are developed and some countries are underdeveloped.
Just a quick service announcement for our listeners. We have a full episode on UCD with Emeritus Professor Justin Rosenberg, so check that one out if you haven't yet. And we'll shortly also talk about how you mobilize UCD in your own approach. But let's talk about the empirics of your book now. So massive congrats again. It's just been published. I think at the time of recording, it's been out for 4 days, published with University of Pittsburgh Press, entitled Dependency and Crisis in Brazil and Argentina, A Critique of Market and State Utopias. Congratulations again. So in your book, you call for a radical redefinition of the very concept of development, which first and foremost, of course, means to shift away from a notion of development in line with the global north. Basically, you look at how the two main development strategies in Latin America, neoliberalism and neo-developmentalism, have failed to bring about real progress in Brazil and Argentina. So what you're doing is suggesting a new approach. Which alternative do you suggest to addressing development challenges using ideas from dependency theory?
Okay, so that's a very big question. Let me take it in parts. So
takes a book to answer this question, I'm sure.
this is really the question I try to answer in the first chapter of the book. So I think the starting point here for this conversation is, again, development, right? So we know that development is very problematic as a notion. We know that horrors have been done in the name of development. We know that horrors continue to be done in the name of development. So if you look at World Bank, IMF policies, they tend to justify everything in terms of development, explicitly so. Catching up, convergence is the word that is now normally used. And this has a history that really cannot be defended, right? At the same time, you still see claims for development coming from the global south, both at the political level. So you see political elites, ruling classes claiming for development, but also and crucially from social movements. They still talk about development all the time, right? I mean, there is something new going on in Latin America, some definitions of development in line with Buen Vivir and other forms of development. But if you look at social movements, political movements in Latin America, and crucially the political debate, the mainstream political debate in every Latin American election is about development. This shows that development is not dead, like post-development authors wanted to see. They tried very hard to kill development in the 1990s, and I'm sorry to say they didn't succeed. And there is a reason for that. It's because we need some notion of development to tell a story. If you are having a narrative about anything, you need some notion that some things happen before the other. So you need a way of organizing your facts that are not just random. Right, so you need a notion of development. One thing happened after the other, one thing caused the other. So a certain idea of development is really inseparable from the idea of telling a story. And also you need a language to express something that you want. So you want to say that the world can be better. And development became this language of saying, oh, this is what we want. We want a developed country. We want a path towards development. So development plays these two key roles. One is organizing a narrative, and the other one is expressing something that you desire. The problem here, then, is to finding a way of defining development that does not reify the division between developed and underdeveloped, but that can fulfill these two roles that development play in any narrative. And I think uneven and combined development does exactly that. And even uncombined development allows us to demoralize development. And here I'm thinking of demoralizing in a way that is not necessarily humiliating development. It's to taking the moral stance of development, right? So development is not necessarily capitalist catch-up. Development is not necessarily convergence to the living standards and the per capita income of so-called developed countries. Development, in the way I define it, using an even combined development, is the interaction between international pressures and opportunities and class struggle and social struggles, including forms of resistance to gender oppression, racialized oppression, class oppression. So development is what actually happens, right? There is no failure to develop. There are different forms of development. And actually, all forms of development are uneven and combined, even in the global north. So the very origins of capitalism comes from one form of uneven and combined development, as Annie Evers and Nizan Sioglu show in their book, How the West Came to Rule. So I think the key thing here is understanding that you can have history unfolding, you can have interaction between international pressures and class struggles and other forms of societal struggle. And this produces a result that is sometimes may take the form of capitalist catch-up, and this is really the rarest form it can take, but many times it can take the form of reproduced dependency. So in my book, I talk about uneven and combined dependency. It's how uneven and combined development reproduces key structures of dependency, such as super-exploitation of labor and the role that ruling classes have in Latin America that is dominant, that is contrary to catch-up development.
Thank you so much. Just to get the ontology clear here again, because it seems to me that still capitalism is the ordering principle. But how can we theorize and understand development beyond the framework of capitalist development? Because according to UCD, the very origin of capitalism was uneven. In other words, capitalism itself was a form or an outcome of uneven and combined development. And yet, capitalism seems to hold a position above multiple diverse societies, considering that the origin and perpetuation of capitalism is characterized by uneven and combined development, driven by inter-societal interactions and class struggle, continuously reshaping diverse societies globally. So how do you instead suggest theorizing and understanding development, if not in terms of capitalist development?
Yeah, I think that this is such a broad question that really allows me to go one step back here and think about the relationship between capitalism and development. So one way to understand development is, and it's interesting to see that there is quite a lot of commonality there between a liberal view of capitalism and a Marxist view of capitalism, at least from a Eurocentric Marxist perspective. So development is the unfolding of capitalist forces of production, according to this view, which I will criticize in a minute, but now I'm just like laying the argument. So the idea is that you had capitalism emerging in some European country, normally England, and then these relations of production spread around the world, and capital looks for higher rates of return, so it tends to expand to places where labor is cheaper, and later where environmental standards are lower because it allows for higher rates of return. And in the Marxist version, this is a horrible process, but it's kind of necessary if you want to eventually overcome capitalism around the world. In the liberal version, this is all good and sound, and eventually technology and trade and interaction, positive interaction between countries will create ways to overcome the hardships of capitalism. So everyone eventually has to pass through very hard forms of exploitation, like England did back in the day. And now you see the sweatshops around the world and super exploitation of labor in the periphery. But this is just a phase of development, right? So you have this idea of stages of development or transition from pre-capitalist societies to capitalism. I find this story very, very problematic for many reasons. The fundamental reason is that the very origin of capitalism was uneven and combined, right? So the very origin of capitalism depended on inter-societal interactions and depended on class struggle. So capitalism then becomes in itself a form of development, a form of uneven and combined development. I think what is really important is to open the realm of possibilities for other forms of development within capitalism and beyond capitalism. So in any case, what we have is a form of development that is not necessarily defined through the steps that you would expect. In fact, if you look at the history of expansion of capitalism, you don't have almost any case of slavish reproduction of the stages of development that you would expect. You have different forms of development happening in different countries all at the same time. So you don't, I refuse this idea that you had capitalism here being reproduced and creating these relations of production in one country after another. And I rather think of capitalism as creating this relationship between many countries and many societies that develop in their own way. So you don't really have a developed capitalist society and an underdeveloped capitalist society. All societies kind of coexist in the same historical time. And the transition then to capitalism is the transition that happens in many places at the same time because they all interact with each other, right? So I'm in that point, I'm much closer to Wallstein than to Brenner. But I do see the problem there of defining capitalism not in relation to the structures of production. But at the same time, if you look at forms of production in countries that were dominated by slavery in Latin America and in North America, you see that those forms of production were also fundamentally capitalist, right? Although you didn't have the free worker there, but you have the profit motive all the way, and you have a connection to markets that were created through the free worker. So I think it's really a mistake to see capitalism as emerging in one country and reproducing country after country, and then having this rolling of history from England to the rest of the world. I think it's much more productive to look at interactive global history of capitalism that takes different forms in different countries. That is, that takes uneven and combined forms of development in different countries. I'm not sure I'm being perfectly clear here. I think that the idea that we see in uneven and combined development, and that we also see in the early dependency literature, is that development should not be reified as that kind of political, economic, and social development that happened in some part of the world, and instead should be analyzed in a holistic way, looking at the experiences of different societies, look at class struggle in different societies. And then what you have is actually different forms of development instead of one standard of development that gets reproduced over and over again.
Thank you so much. If we look at gendered and racialized forms of oppression, which are a global phenomenon, how do they contribute to the self-reproduction of dependency? And why is it important to address these aspects in dependency theory?
Yeah, this is really, really a great question. And it's also a big limitation of the first generation of dependency theory. So how do we put together gender and racialized form of oppression and dependency theory? First, let me say that in the original dependency literature, there's a big silence about race. And that's very puzzling, because they were writing in very racialized societies. And if you look at the early work of Cardozo, even before he started writing about dependency theory, he has a book about slavery. So it's not that they didn't realize the impact of slavery in Latin American societies and in the creation of dependency. But in the canonical works of dependency in development in Latin America and in the Dialectics of Dependency by Marini, you don't see anything about race. And this absence really bothers me. And I think we should think about ways to not have race as an afterthought, saying, oh, yeah, and there is also racialized forms of oppression, but like really connect racialized forms of oppression with the key concept of dependency theory. And I will say how to do that in a second. But let me do the same thing in relation to gender here. Where does gender sit in the first generation of dependency scholars? Some people believe that gender was also totally absent, and that's not exactly true. So there are some writings by Vania Bambija, one of the few women in the first generation of dependency. Vania Bambija was great. It's really a shame that she's not more known in the global north, and her writings have never been translated. Now we are seeing a translation of Marini's The Dialectics of Dependency. We really hope to see Vania Bambija's books being translated, because they are great. They're so well written. So Vania Bambija has some writings on gender. They are not their main writings, but She wrote for some journals about gender and about gender and dependency when she was in Chile. And these writings still have to be recovered. Someone has to go there and do some archival work to dig them. I have a few copies, but I don't have all of them. So there is something there to be rediscovered.
All scholars out there and listeners, so please do and excavate these writings.
I know of some postdoc researchers who are now aiming to do that. Let me say, there are still a lot of archives of dependency theory to explore. We are doing a parenthesis here, like dependency sources, right? I think it's a worth parenthesis to do. A few years ago, I went to the University of California in Riverside, and there is a treasure to be discovered there in terms of dependency archives, because a professor called Ronald Chilcott, who is still with us, is the managing director of Latin American Perspectives, is really a legend in Latin American studies. He has been around since the 60s, and he has an amazing archive of original dependency sources, from pamphlets to interviews. So he recorded in tape a lot of interviews with the original dependency writers, and I spent a whole summer there in California listening to these tapes and getting their own understanding of dependency. And there's a lot to be written based on these archives, but also on the Marini archives in Mexico and the archives by Vane Bambija. And many of the sources are actually online. So if people bother to search for them, the problem is many of them are in Portuguese and Spanish. So this is something that requires some linguistic skills. Okay, but back to gender and race and how we can connect them organically with dependency theory. So the version of dependency theory that I find more productive is Marini's version, right? And of course, updated with a broader understanding of development based on uneven and combined development. But the key idea there is the super exploitation of labor. So we explain the reproduction of dependency based on the fact that the working class is super exploited in the global periphery. And this generates a structure that results in the constant extraction of value from the periphery to the global north. Now, super exploitation is a very, very contested and difficult concept. We have many global north Marxists criticizing the idea, and it seems to contradict a key insight by Marx, that is, the working class is exploited not because it's not paid at its value. So this is getting a little bit technical, but I think we'll have some good Marxist listeners that will like to think together on these issues. And so the idea is that the working force is actually paid at its value, right? And the value of the working force, of course, is the cost of reproduction of labor in different societies. And here, for me, is a fundamentally problematic aspect of Marx, because he talks about the level of civilization when he talks about the conditions for reproduction of the working class. So he says, oh, okay, the worker needs to eat, needs shelter, and those conditions are defined by the level of civilization of different societies. So what you have is actually the different in value of labor is based on the different social demands for social reproduction of work, and this is all natural. So you don't have super exploitation, you have the payment of labor at the level that is required in the level of development or level of civilization of different societies. Now, what Marini says, okay, it is true that the worker is exploited in normal capitalist relations of production, and this works for capitalism because, of course, the worker can produce more value than the value of its social reproduction. But if you look at the global south, the worker is not only exploited, the worker is super exploited. That is, the worker doesn't get even the necessary for self-reproduction. To which orthodox Marxists can say, well, that's impossible. If you don't get enough for social reproduction, you will die, right? How can you have a sustained relationship of getting less than what you need to reproduce yourself? You're going to die. And the answer from the dependency tradition is, yes, the workers die, right? This kind of reproduction started with slavery. So you had the workforce that was disposable, so they could die. You super exploit that individual until they die, and that's horrible. And you have a continuity of that kind of exploitation. So you need some other hidden sources of value there. And this is the point where you can really connect gender and race. Because for the working class to be super exploited, you need some form of reproduction of the working class that is not taken into account. And this connects very well with the feminist literature that's saying, oh, reproductive work is not being paid here. So you have reproductive work done by women, not recognized, not paid, that is subsidizing and making possible the super exploitation of labor. Can you see that? So gender oppression is really, really part of what makes possible super exploitation of labor. And another key part of super exploitation of labor is, of course, if you are willing to make your worker, to let your worker die, you have to dehumanize your worker. You have to fundamentally not see your worker as someone that is entitled to any rights and that is fundamentally different from you. And you here, I'm thinking about Latin American ruling classes, right? So Latin American ruling classes see themselves as European, and that's very easy to see. Even many of them have European passports and have European origins and are white and pass as white Europeans in Europe and in the United States. And they see the working class as fundamentally indigenous and black. So racialization has really, really an important role to sustain super exploitation over time. So I think only through racialization and gender oppression we can understand and justify super exploitation, which is a core concept of dependency theory. So gender and race really should be fundamental parts of dependency theory. But unfortunately, we are only waking up to this reality now, of course, using feminist literature, anti-racist literature. And I think there is a very productive dialogue to have that between dependency and these forms of literature, because we are basically saying the same thing. And the dependency literature helps this literature to connect racialized and gender forms of oppression to forms of oppression related to global capitalism.
So you have also written on dependency theory with regards to international political economy. Drawing on insights from dependency theory, recent research from within IPE has, for example, discussed currency hierarchy as a driver of ecologically unequal exchange, as for instance pointed out by Christopher Olk in his new article. And in your article with Ingrid van Graven, who you also mentioned before, you argue that dependency theory offers a way to decolonize IPE. Please explain how, and especially also like with regards to where the limits to this endeavor are.
Thank you for this question. As you said, we are not the first people trying to decolonize IPE. I think there is a whole effort of the whole field to think about its origins, the debates that we have in IPE, think critically about them and ask the hard questions. Is IPE fundamentally colonial? Is the gaze of IPE fundamentally defined by global North endeavors? And I think that there is really a case to rethink IPE rather radically and look for other origins of IPE. And what we do there in that article is to try to examine if when IPE was born, and then we, of course, we have official histories of IPE. I'm thinking here of Benjamin Cohen's book that is great, it's so well written and so influential and so helpful really to organize the IPE debates. But he really places IPE in the global north, in the US, with a minor participation of authors based in Canada and the UK, and of course centering in Kilhane, Krasner, and then adding some spicy there with Cox and Susan Strange. And we really think that there is another history to be told about the origins of IPE, or at least there were similar debates happening in different parts of the world, right? And we look at debates happening in Latin America and Africa. We found a conference that happened in Dakar in 1972, and we show that this conference, actually, if you look at the papers there, if you look at the debates there, many of the concerns were similar to those of original IP authors. The context was very similar, right? It's a context of crisis of the dollar hegemony, crisis of the 1970s. But the perspective was, what can we do from a global South perspective? What our countries should be doing, what the working class in the global South should be doing, right? So this is decolonial IP right there. So our point is, instead of thinking about how we can decolonize IP now, What about looking about other origins of IPE? What about looking at people that were doing IPE in a different way and that were considered part of the IPE debates by IPE scholars, right? So most IPE scholars at least give a nod to dependency theory. Gilpin fully engages with dependency theory in the 1980s. The international organization, the main journal of IPE, had an issue on dependency theory in 1978. So it was pretty much part of the big conversation of IPE. And then at some point in the 1980s, late 1980s, they decided that it's really dependency is not part of IPE. And it gets erased from IPE courses. And our point was really to recover a bit that history, show a different origin point of IPE, possibly the Dakar conference. We do not argue that this is the only possible history of IPE that we are offering there, but we are showing that, look, we can tell different histories of IPE.
That was brilliant. Thank you so much. So thinking of, contemporary crisis, I don't even have to start. I think just thinking of the military crisis ongoing, but also the climate crisis. How do you see dependency theory evolving to address these contemporary challenges of global conflict, of global inequalities, of sustainable development?
Thank you so much for this question. This really allows me to talk a little bit about the landscape in the literature today. Because again, as I said right in the beginning, I think there is a tendency of talking about dependency theory as if it's frozen in the 1960s and 70s. Even among dependency authors, right? I find it a little bit frustrating that some colleagues, when you look at their bibliography at the end of the article, they only quote Marini, Dos Santos, Bambira, and Cardoso, and Amin. And of course, we should be going back to them because they are big sources of inspiration, but there's a whole new generation of dependency authors writing about extremely cool stuff. So let me give our listeners a bit of an overview to that, because I really want to promote that literature that I find so impressive and so inspiring. So the first thing to notice is that we are in the middle of a new dependency theory boom. If you go to the Web of Sciences and search for dependency theories in quotation marks or inverted commas, and generate a citation report, you will find 900 publications cited over 15,000 times, which include dependency theory in the title or abstract. So dependency theory is really booming right now. If you generate a graph of those citations and publications, you'll see that in the 1970s and 80s, we had about 3, maybe 4 or 5 publications a year. And the number of publications dropped to 0 in 1989. I think 1989 is really the year that dependency theory hit rock bottom. And then picked up a bit in the 1990s, but dropped again to 3 publications a year by 2004. So I'm talking about a fairly recent history here. But then since 2004, the number of publications and citations skyrocketed. In 2019, we had 53 publications. In 2021, 92. And last year, we had 101 publications and more than 2,000 citations. So even controlling for the fact that probably some of these publications are not really directly related to dependency theory and just use the expression dependency theory, it is clear that dependency literature is really booming. And another way to put it is that last year, probably, we had more scholarly work on dependency than in the 1970s and 80s put together. And let it sink. Like last year, we had more scholarship on dependency theory than in the 1980s and 70s put together. So we are really, really in a new era of dependency theory, right? So looking at the literature available in English, and here, let me apologize to my colleagues speaking Spanish and Portuguese. I think most of the literature in dependency is still in Portuguese and Spanish, but since we are in an English-speaking podcast, I will focus in English-speaking dependency literature. So if you look at the literature available in English, I think we can divide the new dependency or the literature in general, actually, in 3 broad groups. So first, you have the classical works of Gunda Frank, Marini, Dos Santos, Amin, Wena Bambira, which is unfortunately not yet translated into English. And here, the most important things that we have are translations. So we have the translation
of Marini's Dialectics of Dependency. And let me applaud the work Amanda Latimer did there. It's so important to have the Dialectics of Dependency in English. So thank you so much, Amanda, for taking that challenge and doing this brilliant translation, which I'm using to teach. And this is really important. And if you haven't read anything of dependency theory, the place to start is the Dialectics of Dependency.
We'll go straight into the show notes.
So it's still on the same shelf as classical dependency theory. I would put some contemporary works of senior professors who studied directly with the first generation of dependentistas and continue to write pretty much in the same tradition. And I'm thinking of Jaime Osorio, Sotelo Valencia, Carlos Eduardo Martins, etc. And they mostly write in Portuguese and Spanish, but they have recent translations. So I would recommend checking the work of these professors as well. Then there's a growing history and historiography of dependency theory. And the highlight here is the book I already quoted by Margarita Fajardo called The World Latin America Created. It's a brilliant history of dependency theory. I don't agree with everything there. I think she gives a lot of emphasis to the CEPAL tradition, which is fair. But I think it's very important to mark the difference between the CEPAL tradition and dependency theory. But it's a book that is really changing the historiography of dependency and, again, must be read. Then, of course, there is the very classical book by Cristóbal Caio called Latin American Theories of Development and Underdevelopment. It's a great starting point. And there's a new translation by Claudio Katz called Dependency 50 Years Later, just published by Brill last year, if I'm not mistaken, and it's also highly recommended. And if you put it all together, you start to have a kind of a historiography of dependency in English, which is really helpful for people teaching dependency theory. And then finally, getting to the core of your question, there is a whole new generation of scholars in Latin America, the US, and Europe, and Africa writing about dependency today. And this is where I place myself, right? I'm less interested in scholastic debates about what Marini really said or what Dos Santos really said, and more interested about how can we use dependency theory to criticize political economy in Brazil and Argentina today and in other parts of the world. So it's really about using dependency theory as a life theory to tackle contemporary issues. And names here include, of course, Martin Arboleda, Ingrid Van Graven, Joana Salem Vasconcelos, Stefano Palestini, Aldo Mandariaga, Mariano Feliz, among many others. Topics vary from the application of dependency theory to new cases. So countries, this is a classic application of dependency theory, right? This country is developing in this specific way. But also new areas, right? You have dependency theory on talking about specific industry areas. I read a brilliant article the other day on dependency theory and video games. You also have literature trying to address the silence of dependency theory about gender and race. And about gender, I really, really want to commend the work that Belén Villegas-Pla is doing. She published an article in Third World Quarterly titled Dependency Theory Meets Feminist Economics, a Research Agenda, that is really brilliant, and she's really starting to get the work of Vanessa Bambira that I mentioned earlier and start exploring it and taking very interesting insights out of it. So my point here is that really, like, the field is open, and there is a whole new generation of people using dependency to talk about contemporary issues, from extractivism with Marcinha Arboleda to feminism. I still see a bit of a silence about dependency and race. So I wrote a book chapter about dependency and race, actually about dependency and gender and race. And I really would like to see someone making more effort to bridge dependency theory and the Black radical tradition and anti-racist literature and critical race theory. So I think there is a whole opportunity there for someone to take it and really use dependency to dialogue with these new streams of literature. But it is quite inspiring now. I've been reviewing a lot of articles on dependency theory. Every week, a different journal asks me to review an article. And I always learn new things. And I'm really inspired by the way people are taking dependency, as I said, as a life tradition to explain problems in the contemporary world, and to contrast that with other contemporary forms of literature instead of just talking about the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, thank you so much. We definitely learned a lot today. Thank you so much for this really rich and great conversation.
Thank you, Judith. That was great. Really a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Please find all information on today's interview guests and host in the show notes. Voices, the EISA podcast, is available on all established podcast platforms. If you liked it, subscribe now. Voices, the EISA podcast, feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible.